Homeland Security authorities recently raided homes in Texas, Georgia, and North Carolina, rounding up Central American families whose asylum claims have been rejected. I'm Virginia Alvino, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues in states along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. At least 121 people have been detained out of 100,000 who entered the U.S. illegally over the past 2 years. Those being deported are mainly young mothers with children. NPR's John Burnett visited with some of them in Texas.
When I arrive at the house in East Austin, there are kids playing outside and eyes peeking through curtains at the street. The ongoing raids by Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, have terrified immigrants who lost their cases and await deportation. People like Hilda Ramirez.
Hola, Hilda.
Hola.
¿Cómo está?
I'd met Hilda before. She's a diminutive 28-year-old Mayan mother from San Marcos, Guatemala, in a pink T-shirt and jean shorts. Her bright-eyed son, Ivan, is 9. She says they left Central America to flee Ivan's abusive grandparents. They crossed the Rio Grande in August 2014 and surrendered to the Border Patrol. They spent the next year and a half in an ICE detention center and here in this shelter home run by an Austin nonprofit. Both her and her son's asylum requests were turned down. Hilda wears an electronic ankle monitor, which is how ICE knows exactly where she is.
Siento que son ellos cada vez que llega los carros.
Hilda says every time a car stops on this quiet cul-de-sac, she thinks it's federal agents who've come to take her away. She can't sleep. She's afraid. Ramirez has reason to be. Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson announced Monday that the roundup of Central American families has begun. I know there are many who loudly condemn our enforcement efforts as far too harsh, he says in a statement, while there will be others who say the actions don't go far enough. After they're picked up in the current raids, immigrant families are taken to a detention center in Dilley, Texas, to await deportation. Ana Urias is there now with her 4 children, ages 3 to 17.
Pues como a mí me andaban bien localizada, bien monitoreada por mi grillete que andaba.
I was easy to find because of the electronic ankle monitor on my leg, says Urias, from a phone inside the building. She's a 32-year-old mother from Usulutan province, El Salvador, who says she fled because murderous gangs were threatening her family. Urias says ICE agents showed up at the door of her apartment in Atlanta Sunday morning at 11 o'clock, but she wouldn't let them in. Then they called her and said they were actually there because her ankle monitor was broken, so she opened the door. Once inside, they told her to get her kids together and go with them. They were very angry, she says. They didn't give me a chance to do anything. I was in my pajamas and slippers. I said I wanted to call my lawyer. I didn't even have a chance to brush my hair. It all happened so fast. They fingerprinted me and took us to the airport. When we got to the airplane, there were 20, 25 police waiting for 4 families, she says. 4 women with our children. Why so much security? We're deportable families, not criminals. Immigrant advocates are furious with the government. Though both women in this story had lawyers and still lost their asylum claims, advocates say that most applicants don't have representation and end up losing their cases. Cecilia Wong is director of the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project. She calls the sweeps by ICE an elaborate and unjust show.
The federal government is going to engage in fear tactics, storming into people's homes in early morning hours in order to deter others.
Secretary Johnson says, quote, "Our borders are not open to illegal immigration. If you come here illegally, we will send you back, consistent with our laws and values." John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
John Burnett's report originally aired January 5th on NPR's All Things Considered. Visa violations have focused attention on border security, and stepped-up screening is now underway at one crossing between California and Mexico. In San Diego, agents are now using facial and eye screening technology to identify who's crossing the border. But as David Wagner of KPBS reports for Fronteras, civil liberties advocates also say the new techniques are testing the limits of privacy.
At the Otay Mesa border crossing, people are lining up to enter the U.S. Many are frequent crossers heading to work, to visit family, or to go shopping. Today, some of them are about to find out that crossing the border now involves another step. A row of brand new kiosks greet them at the front of the line.
Por favor, acércate aquí.
Border agents help them feed their travel documents into the kiosks. Then, if they're a U.S. citizen, they're ushered across the border. But the non-U.S. citizens are asked to stay back for a moment.
Look in the mirror.
They have to stand very still while a camera inside the kiosk scans their face and eyes. Customs and Border Protection Assistant Port Director Joseph Meisenhelter explains this is all part of a pilot program evaluating biometrics at the border.
This is a national security issue as far as looking for individuals who are violating the law.
He says the agency wants to know if tracking uniquely identifying facial features can help better screen people crossing the border. For the next 6 months, Otay Mesa will be their testing grounds. It's currently the only land crossing where pedestrians will have their faces routinely scanned. If the test is deemed successful, face scanning could expand to other border stops.
This will address certain issues as far as, is that the same person on the document, potential visa overstays, so we'll know with certainty, did that person really leave the United States?
When I asked border crossers how they felt about the new level of screening, most were fine with it. Abel Gongora said he just hopes it cuts down on wait times.
If that's going to improve that, you know what I mean?
Gongora is an American citizen who lives in Tijuana for its cheap rent, but he works in the U.S. as a music instructor. The border can make his commute excruciatingly long.
I really need to get over there. I need to get over there, you know?
Even Mexican citizens said they were more concerned about wait times than anything else. Cesar Quesada said getting his face scanned was no big deal.
It's very easy. Now it's more quick. I think maybe 1-3 seconds.
But civil liberties advocates wonder if border crossers are too willing to trade their personal information for shorter waits. Mitra Ebadalahi is a border litigation attorney with the ACLU's chapter in San Diego. She's worried that this focus on physical features could contribute to racial profiling. She tells border crossers they should be more concerned about the future of face scanning at the border.
I would say your interest in getting through the border as quickly as possible is a valid one. But if you pay for that convenience by giving up a photo of yourself, and that photo then gets into a database, not just at the border, but potentially used elsewhere, and then is used to connect you to a crime that you didn't commit, because you sort of look like a guy who the victim of that crime has identified as being the perpetrator, how would you feel about the government having that information on file for you indefinitely?
Customs and Border Protection says these new biometrics compare favorably with the accuracy of fingerprint scanning, and it says the images collected during this test will not be shared with other agencies. As for whether or not the new screening improves wait times, border crossers may need to be patient to hear the results. For Fronteras, I'm David Wagner.
A new year means new laws, and it's now legal for gun owners with concealed carry licenses to carry openly in Texas. But will those licensed holders actually do so? KUT's Audrey McGlinchey checked with some gun owners to find out.
To call Michael Cargill vocal about his gun rights might be an understatement.
And just so you know, right now, I'm carrying two handguns on me right now, and they're both concealed. I have a .45 and a .38 Special on me right now, and they're concealed. So welcome to Central Texas Gunworks.
Cargill owns Central Texas Gunworks in South Austin. He also teaches a handgun license course, usually the first step for folks applying for what's now called a concealed handgun license. Tomorrow, it will simply be known as a license to carry. Cargill's had to update his curriculum to include information on the state's new open carry law, like how to openly carry.
That handgun will need to be in a holster if you're going to openly carry that handgun. It will need to be in a holster that fits on your belt or a shoulder holster, okay, if you're going to carry it in the open.
The rest of the law is not very new. For example, where are you prohibited from openly carrying your gun? Anywhere a concealed weapon is also not allowed. Elementary, middle, or high schools, sporting events, or in most bars. Private business owners can restrict visitors as well, but they have to hang a state-approved sign if they don't want someone openly carrying inside.
Any questions? All right.
Hey, yeah, I got one. Will those with licenses to carry actually open carry? License holders have always had the option of carrying or not, but the handgun had to be hidden. Now, they have another choice. So, will they go plain sight or no?
I did use the word embarrassing about open carrying, and I think the idea of carrying a weapon like that You know, I've really got to think about that.
Meet John Beattie. He lives in Dallas and recently wrote a column for the Dallas Morning News titled "Why My Handguns Will Remain Concealed." As we talk more, he eventually comes up with some metaphors to explain his thinking. The first one has to do with butterflies.
Having a handgun on my hip would be like wearing a pair of man-sized butterfly wings. Having it is calling unwanted attention to yourself. I don't really think it's necessary.
Then we got talking about watches.
You wear a Rolex because you want people to know you're wearing a Rolex. You open carry a gun because you want people to know you're carrying a gun. I think most people don't want people to know they're carrying a gun.
One of your greatest advantages if you are a CHL holder is the advantage of surprise.
Here's Austin Police Chief of Staff Brian Manley.
I do think that it's something that folks should give serious consideration to, that one of the best things you have on your side is time, and you actually have extra time to react if you're carrying in a concealed capacity because you're less likely to have been identified early on by this person as someone who's a threat to them.
It's something Austin Police Chief Art Acevedo said in February as he sat in front of state lawmakers debating the then-proposed open carry bill.
If two people walk into the bank, one's an open carry, one is a concealed carry, and there's some eight-tray Hoover Crips who are out here on vacation and decided to rob that bank, who do you think is going to get shot first? Who do you think has the tactical advantage? I don't think I need to answer that question.
Michael Cargill from Central Texas Gun Works was at that same hearing, speaking in favor of open carry. So I had to ask him, will you openly carry?
Once January 1st kicks in, I don't expect really to openly carry because I really don't like for people to see what type of gun I carry.
Regardless, Cargill and others say they're grateful for the right. They say it's a constitutional right. Some will undoubtedly exercise that right. But for the time being, Cargill and others like him say they'll keep their guns tucked away. For Fronteras, I'm Audrey McGlinchey.
Coming up next on Fronteras, college campuses in Texas have to deal with the gun law, too.
When people hear campus carry, they're like, oh my gosh, guns are going to be all over campus, but it's really not going to be that way.
That story, and a decision that greatly helps Spanish-speaking parents of special needs children, after this. I'm Virginia Alvino, and this is Fronteras. As gun owners and businesses react to open carry in Texas, later this year, another gun law called campus carry goes into effect. Guns must be concealed at colleges. As KERA's Bill Zeeble reports, campuses are trying to figure out how the new law will work.
The new campus carry law allows concealed handgun license holders to carry guns on public college campuses. It takes effect in August. For months, college students and faculty have debated the new law, including University of Texas schools and those in the University of North Texas system.
When people hear campus carry, they're like, oh my gosh, guns are going to be all over campus, but it's really not going to be that way. Students aren't just going to be walking around with guns on their hips.
Christopher Lee is the student body vice president at UNT in Denton. He's part of a campus task force studying how to implement the law. He wants to balance fears of some with statistics.
We looked at numbers across the state, and the number of people who are eligible on campus versus the number of students who are people in the state of Texas who actually carry is a very, very, very small percentage.
That's partly because only those 21 years and older can get a license. The UNT task force studied Colorado, the state with the most years of a campus carry law, 12. There had been few campus gun incidents there. UNT professor Eric Fritsch, who chairs the Department of Criminal Justice, says Colorado State University reported no discharges or displays of handguns by license holders in that time. The University of Colorado Boulder reported one. A staffer accidentally fired the weapon. Two people had minor injuries. The staffer was fired.
We have 12 years of history in another state, and we have one accidental discharge of a firearm. There's a lot of concern, I think, among people that this is going to lead to an increase in violence on campus, and there's just really no evidence to support that at all.
That hasn't stopped students or faculty from debating the Texas law, pro and con. Private colleges can opt out. Several have, including Texas Christian University in Fort Worth. Nursing major Gracie Cable says she's fine around guns, but doesn't see the need on campus.
I don't personally feel like I'm in an unsafe environment. If anything, like you can carry mace or, you know, do something, but I think guns a little extreme.
But the president of TCU Campus Republicans, Caleb Chappell, thinks it's extreme to prohibit guns.
Nothing is stopping a student from carrying on campus right now. The difference, in my opinion, in the future, if TCU had opted in to campus carry, is that professor or any other student in that classroom who's law-abiding would have had the ability to stop that situation.
In Austin, UT System Chancellor William McCraven disagrees with the campus carry law, but it doesn't matter. The retired four-star admiral and Navy SEAL says he learned a few things after 37 years in the military.
You argue a point up until a decision is made, and once the decision is made, you salute smartly and you move out. We are at that point. The state legislature passed this law, the governor signed it, so now we have an obligation to follow the law.
While Texas public colleges cannot opt out of the law, they're coming up with plans where they want guns restricted. They're called gun-free zones. Some want to keep guns out of dorms or classrooms, but Attorney General Ken Paxton said last month that would likely be illegal. UNT hopes to have its recommendations ready for regents to consider in February. For Fronteras, I'm Bill Zeeble.
Having a child in special education can be a maze for parents and teachers. There are important forms and meetings to make sure students receive the appropriate services. Imagine trying to make sense of it all if you don't speak English and translations are hard to come by. Houston Public Media's education reporter Laura Eisensee has one family story.
The purpose of this meeting was to address some concerns that Ms. Aguirre had.
You're listening to a special education meeting between Houston school officials and Rosa Aguirre about her daughter Lupita Carvajal. Aguirre called the meeting because she was worried Lupita wasn't receiving basic services, like enough water to drink, after she landed in the hospital. Aguirre also asked for documents in Spanish. This is a sample of what she received.
She's an advocate with disability rights, and she's our interpreter.
And this has already been addressed in the past.
Did you have a hard time understanding that? So did Aguirre. The tape is over an hour long, has pockets of distortion, and captures little Spanish translation. Aguirre specifically wanted a copy of Lupita's Individualized Education Program, or IEP, in Spanish. It's a key document for special needs children. It's almost like a contract between parents and the school district, so that they can collaborate and make sure the child makes progress.
Los padres que hablamos español.
Parents who speak Spanish, I believe we have the right to know what they're saying, what they're requiring, or what they want us to sign.
Lupita is 14 years old and in the ninth grade. She has cerebral palsy and uses an electric wheelchair. And Lupita doesn't understand why it's so hard for her mom to receive translations.
Make my mom mad and me mad because for my mom, it's hard to read it in English. Yeah.
But when asked about written copies, HISD administrators told Aguirre and her attorney,
a blatant no, sorry, we don't do that, was just unacceptable to me. It was just unacceptable.
That's Sarah Beebe with Disability Rights Texas. She met Aguirre and other parents who were being refused documents in Spanish. So the advocacy group filed complaints with the Texas Education Agency.
We described it as a discriminatory practice.
Beebe says the special education process is complex enough for any parent.
When you add a language barrier and you don't accommodate that language barrier, it is just made that much more difficult for that parent to work with the school and fully understand all of their rights, all of their child's rights, all of the services that they can avail themselves of.
Technically, Texas law allows for a written or audio tape translation of a child's personal education program. But when state officials investigated complaints from Aguirre and other parents, they determined the recordings from HISD weren't good enough. They ordered written copies. Beebe says that at first, HISD responded by trying to change the state law on the issue and calling a meeting at the legislature.
Well, there's been no lobbying around translation. There's just been a request to clarify the requirement.
Soumya Kumar is an assistant superintendent at HISD. She says currently translating is tedious and costly, so they're working with a software company to provide automated, simultaneous translations.
We are then able to hit a translate button and out comes the same information in another language. So we're in the process of working through that right now.
Houston and all Texas school districts are facing new rules. State officials say an audio tape translation can't be just a recording of a meeting. It has to cover all aspects of a child's individualized education program. And every parent must get a written copy of the original document in English at no cost. That's good news for Rosa Aguirre.
Está perfecto lo que van a hacer.
It's perfect. That's going to be perfect because that way moms and teachers can work together better, which is what the child needs.
¿Qué es lo que el niño necesita?
I'm Laura Eisensee.
And the U.S. Postal Service is honoring the late beloved educator Jaime Escalante with a postage stamp this year. Escalante's work with inner-city students in Los Angeles was portrayed in the 1988 film Stand and Deliver. Edward James Olmos played the popular, flamboyant teacher who died in 2010. Escalante emigrated from Bolivia and pushed his students with strenuous homework assignments and strict attendance requirements. His students mastered the challenging subject of calculus and advanced placement exams. Each year, the Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee vets thousands of suggestions. USPS spokesman Roy Betts says Escalante's legacy makes him an ideal candidate for the honor. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Charenga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Virginia Elvino at Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks so much for joining us this week.